terminological question.
Yeah.
Why does he use the concept of substance to talk about ethics? It's just, I don't know, concern.
I mean, he uses it here in regard to the ethical community. Because it's regarded as something that is self-subsistent. And to some degree, you could say that the individuals are accidents of it. That is, they are part and parcel of this ethical community. And they don't have any independent existence apart from it. Their agency is something that they have in virtue of their membership. And for that reason, it's not something to which they can stand back, extricate themselves, and, for example, engage in the kind of testing of laws, for example, whereby they might judge, are the laws of the ethical community laws that are rational, for example. So I think that's the main nutshell for how it's been used.
I wonder whether this substance is just the opposite, dependent on individuals' behavior.
Well, it consists of their behavior. But the behavior they engage in is a behavior that can only be engaged in if the community is already at hand. You know, their activity is not an activity that produces it as a product of an activity that is not part of the product they produce. They are reproducing something to which they belong as being members of the ethical community.
Given the laws of the community are subject to change, if individuals can change laws, what is being denoted by actual substance is the very nature of the existence of laws in general.
Now here you have an immediate ethical community that's spoken of as immediate, where there isn't any mention of any activity that consists in making laws. And there is a question of whether you can think of an ethical community as involving an activity including lawmaking. And, you know, there's some people who want to argue that you can't have political freedom unless individuals have the freedom to determine everything regarding the body politic, as if, in other words, they don't have if they don't have the power to make the constitution, they can't be free in being subject to a constitutional order or belonging to a constitutional order. But you know, the making of the constitution is not a constitutional activity. It's an activity that doesn't reproduce something, and is not part of what it brings into being. Whereas if you can have a constitutional order, which includes an activity of legislating, such as any modern state, any modern constitutional state. But I think what's significant is that you can only engage in the activity of lawmaking by being a member of a pre-existing body politic, so structured as to give you institutions of legislation to partake in. Which could also involve having, you know, a power to amend a constitution. So I think one can think of an ethical community in those terms. And that might also be a way of thinking about how one could have an ethical community that doesn't have any naturally given character. And Hegel in his philosophy of right, which is a work in which he is going to be attempting to lay out what are the institutions of freedom, having established elsewhere that normativity can reside in nothing other than self-determination, is going to lay out spheres of ethical community, including a household, civil society, and a state, which should be, on its own, in terms of its own principles, be structured independently of any natural givenness. Well, I think you'll see if you look at how he does it that he doesn't properly do that. I've tried to fix it in a series of books. You can check them out at your leisure. The Just Economy, Law and Civil Society, The Just Family, The Just State, and all of these, I'm trying to do it right, basically. Now here, by the way, in speaking about this operation of faith, there's another side to it, which I think has a significance that helps us understand the way in which the Rechtszustand, the legality that arises from this natural ethical community, is depicted. Because it's depicted as a kind of universal community, a world community, not a community restricted to a people. And I think to understand how that would be the case, you have to keep in mind the other side, which Hegel brings in rather late in the game in paragraph 474, where he refers to the role of war. And I think he's referring to war really as another side of fate. Because on the one hand, you have this fateful, irreconcilable encounter of different ethical spheres within the natural ethical community, where the antagonists have no way of reconciling their conflict. But the same kind of conflict, irreconcilable conflict, takes place at the level of the opposition of one people to another people. Because both of them have ethical communities whose law is particular to themselves and does not make appeal to any further principles that could adjudicate between them. So they're basically in a situation of irreconcilable conflict. So there's a fate that takes over everyone, both domestically and internationally, without any limits. And it takes over not because of anything apart from these institutions, but the institutions themselves are so constituted that they're bound to engage in these kind of conflicts. And so Hegel says, you know, on paragraph 475, we have a demise of ethical substance and its transition to another shape. And it's determined because of the fact that the ethical consciousness that inhabits all of these ethical substances are immediately directed to law. And this determination of immediacy means that nature itself enters into ethical life's action. And that immediacy has here, you know, a contradictory meaning. Because you have, on the one hand, the restfulness of nature, that is the given fixity of nature, a natural determinacy. And then on the other hand, the restlessness of mind and spirit. You know, you have this restricted individuality confronting other restricted individualities, each determined by nature in some respect. And so that kind of determinacy is here overcome through this conflict. It's purged through the very workings of the structure. And then what arises? Well, he depicts it in the following way. It says, what arises is this kind of universal substance, this universal condition, which everyone now gets subjected to. And it's something that presides over them as a, what he speaks of as a formal universality. A formal universality that is different from the kind of universality of the living spirit of what had been called spiritual essence and ethical community. And they remember the ethical community was one in which membership was something which was not something imposed upon the agency in question, the individuality in question. The individuality in question was one that realized itself only as a member and as part of the unity to which it was presented. Here, by contrast, we have a unity which is an abstract universality, a formal universality. It's formal in the sense that the universality applies to individuals to which it is otherwise indifferent. That is, their own character is in no way determined by their bondage to this unity to which they're subordinate. So it's not going to be something in which they're going to be, shall we say, knowing themselves, right, to be at one with themselves. Rather, they're here in a situation where, in a way, the truth of the experience of ethical community has turned into this general submission to a power which is indifferent to them, and they as individuals are now, in a certain sense, atomized, but all equally atomized, all in relationship to one another, where they're being dealt with as these independent, well, the term used is persons. And it is a lawful relationship, because they are all subject to this same bond. But it's a law that applies to them in such a way that it has something formal about them. And I think it's important to think about what personality here means. Or what you might say being a person or a personhood constitutes. Kant used the term person, as you know, distinguishing persons from things. And he associated persons, as you know, with moral agency. But Hegel is not associating personhood with moral agency. He's associating personhood with the agency of being an owner, to which our translator associates legal personality, or I guess you could say legal status, too. But, you know, there are different ways about thinking about legal status. I mean, if you mean a legal status where the law in question is a law of property, then I think it would be accurate if one restricts it to that. It's obviously law can apply to other things, but there is a kind of civil law that pertains to property owners and regulates their relationships to one another as owners. Now, Hegel's going to distinguish between the person and the moral subject in ways that I think will become clear later on when we look at the section on morality. But one of the... And Hegel, by the way, regards the personhood of property relations as being something that, in a way, moral agency presupposes. As you can't be recognized as a moral agent unless you're also recognized as an owner. But in being recognized as an owner, you're not recognized with respect to your intentions in the way in which you are in morality. Because in morality, you're concerned with interacting with others in respect to acting with the right purposes and motives and the like. But in operating as a person, you just have the status of an owner. And what your purposes and intentions are really besides the point. What counts is simply that you have your ownership recognized and you don't violate the ownership of others. And here's a sphere where you can be held under strict liability for example, what harms befall individuals due to your property, even if you didn't intend it, which is completely different from, you know, moral responsibility. Now, here we're talking about a situation where we have, resulting from the internal in a sense, self-destruction or self-subordination to fate of ethical community, natural ethical community on a global scale, to a submission to a power which lords over people in a way that has broken the bonds of ethical community and instead treats them all in the same way, in a lawful way, and treats them in an abstract way, where they have personhood. And Hegel does speak of it as being something that involves a relationship pertaining to property. They're related to one another as owners. Otherwise, they have no other bonds that have any kind of lawful character. And they're all subject to a power that enforces the legality of their reality as persons. And otherwise, could be said to do whatever it pleases in any other sphere, right? It's left open. You know, as long as their legal status as owners is respected, everything else is in the hands of this power that presides over them. So you have that whole domain in which there's going to be a kind of room for arbitrariness, just as there's an arbitrariness on the part of persons. Because to be a person, to be recognized as a person, to be subject to a law that restricts itself to upholding your rights as an owner, leaves completely unspecified what you own, what you do with what you own, so long as you don't violate the property of others, or what you do in any other respect, as long as you don't violate the ownership of others. I think the question you have to ask is why would this be the form of agency that individuals find themselves in as the outcome of this self-destruction of ethical community? Why would it leave them with these bonds? And also, why with no other bonds than these bonds? And by the way, Hegel, to some degree fleshing all of this out a little bit, compares the situation of personality or personhood with Stoicism, and then also with, in a sense, the rise of skepticism. What are the parallels? Because there are differences, obviously, but there's also a parallel. And this is something he draws in paragraph 478. It says, just as the Stoic, in a way, withdrew from given actuality and retreated into the abstractness and self-identity of thinking, and remember, this is something that followed from the relationships of mastery and servitude. Hegel makes the analogy, well, so personality here emerges from immediate spirit. How does one make the comparison? What is it that, in a sense, could be said to exhibit the same retreat to this kind of identity of thinking? And an identity of thinking or an at-homeness of thought that is a kind of thinking that can withdraw itself from actuality and be at one with itself, be conscious of itself. What is the analog here for that? I mean, Hegel says that, you know, in Stoicism you had this universality in the form of this abstraction, which was simply in the form of thought. Here, it's in the form of actuality. Here, we have an actual world that not only might historically be the world in which the Stoics happen to operate, but happens to be a world in which something akin to Stoicism has become a reality. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it would have anything to do with, well, it depends what you mean by aristocracy. I mean, I don't, do you mean it in the ancient sense of ruled by the best, or?
No, I mean it's the land, I guess the land class.
But here are we talking about something that involves divisions of classes explicitly. Because when we're talking about personhood, we're really talking about something that applies to all. It's a universal status. And I think what's significant about it, it's a status where to be a person, although admittedly under Roman law, to be a person, you had to have certain kinds of requirements that might be regarded to really be incompatible with the nature of personhood. But, you know, to be an owner, all you need to do is to be able to lay your will in a recognized way in something. It could be your body to begin with. It could be any other object. And that capacity is completely indifferent to your gender, to your nationality, to any other kind of particular consideration, to what your needs are, your wants, your desires. I mean, all of those are indifferent. You know, we're not talking about your welfare here. We're simply talking about your status as an owner. You're determining yourself as an owner and being recognized as an owner. And it involves a kind of universal self. Remember, this sort of came up with the thing that matters and the kind of pure subjectivity. There was to be a vehicle of self-realization. Right? To the extent that the self realized itself in any particular manner, as a self that had any kind of particular character, like the natural originary character that figured in the spiritual zoo, there were problems. There was a need to remove that. Well, here we have the removal, in effect, but on a world scale as an existing lawful order, where individuals here relate to one another simply in terms of their abstract status as owners, which binds them in no other respect. Just as their being an owner in no way determines what they own, other than perhaps that they're owner, that they own their own body, or recognized on their own body, in addition to what else they own. So it leaves all of that up for grabs, as well as what they do with their property, as well as how much property they have. Right? You know, your rights as an owner are not being violated if all you own is your own body and nothing else. So all of these things are abstracted from. All of the particulars of actuality are, in a sense, being otherwise ignored. And here we have an actuality that the only thing that determines it, and determines the way individuals relate to one another and can see themselves. I mean, this is a reality where the individual, as a person, has a world that reflects what they are. This is their world. It's a world where everything is reduced merely to legal status. But because of that, the power that presides over this is otherwise completely unrestricted. It doesn't have to give you rights of political self-determination. It doesn't have to give you family rights. It doesn't have to give you social rights of any further sense. It doesn't have to give you bread and circuses. It might choose to, but it doesn't have to. So, you know, the flip side of it is you then have this authority that otherwise, besides upholding personal property as unlimited prerogative. And there's also nothing about it that restricts it to the unity of the people. Because the status of person has nothing to do with your ethnicity or anything of that sort. So for that reason, it can be spoken of as a world empire, but restricted to the source. And so you can see it as still falling within, you know, the general sphere of reason. Because remember, all of these. I mean, first of all, you want to think about it. It may not involve natural ethical unity. That may be destroyed, but it's still spoken of as being a shape of spirit, and by the same token, a shape of reason as spirit. So you want to ask yourself, in what respect do we still have reason as a shape of consciousness here? and spirit. And where do we identify spirit? Dylan, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just asking, does the bare minimal determination of this recognition of ownership, does it just have to consist in ownership of the body? Or does it have to consist in something external to the body?
Well, the reason, I mean, look, Hegel doesn't make this point. I'm making this point. He does make the point in the philosophy of right. And the point is that you can't be recognized to own anything else unless you're also recognized to own your body. And the very simple reason for that is if you're not recognized to own your body, nothing your body does is, juridically speaking, attributable to you. You're just another thing ready for possession. And for example, if you are taken ownership of by another person and become a slave, what you do is not your responsibility. It's your master's will that is responsible. You're just property. So you can't take ownership unless the act by which ownership is taken is recognized to be yours. So your body, which is that through which you're able to do anything, must be recognized to be your own. And it's unique among property in having what feature that all other property would have. It can't be alienated. Because to be alienated, you have to be alienated as an act of property transfer, you have to, as a person, as an owner, be able to give it away. But you can't give your body away. Because as soon as your body is from you, you lose all status as an owner. Nothing you do counts as yours. So you can't somehow be there as an owner or as a recognized agent, in that sense, juridical agent, apart from your body. Despite those who speak about how you could contract to, you know, give yourself, sell yourself into slavery and the like. So that's sort of the basic sense of that. Yeah. Well, I think you want to think about how this stand can be regarded, first of all, as still a configuration of spirit and something of reason. And remember, reason is involved in this enterprise of validating a certainty that it's right. It's either confronting or comprising a world which is at one with self-consciousness. Well, here you have that in a certain sense, and the self in question is the self of the person. And the person here is in a world in which everyone is being treating one another as a person and being protected by a governing agency that upholds a regime of personhood, nothing more than that, and is a person, him or herself. And the question is, can this validate itself? And I suggest next time, let's just begin by thinking about how this shape itself undermines itself, undercuts itself, to what degree it does, and where it's going. Because we're going into this talk of what's considered being, on one hand, the alienation of spirit and the cultivation of spirit. So we'll move into that.